G'day, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. It's a podcast explaining one big news story affecting your world in just 15 minutes. From ABC investigations to politics, the cost of living, to major global events. Expert guests and journalists join me to explain why the world works the way it does. Follow the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
In a moment, you'll hear the latest episode of The Breakfast Wrap. Every morning we take the very best of Radio National Breakfast with Sally Sara, the interviews that you may have missed if you weren't up at 5:30 in the morning, the ones that'll help you understand just what's happening today. We turn it into this 25-minute program, which you can hear right now on Radio National and the ABC Listen app. From Ngunnawal Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap. Why were a group of neo-Nazis able to protest outside the New South Wales Parliament on the weekend? That's the question many are asking this morning, including us, of the New South Wales government.
It's very difficult for police to make decisions, in real time, whilst all this is going on, whether or not they have actually crossed the line from freedom of speech to hate speech.
That interview is coming up. Then, the Liberal Party could be just days away from deciding its future climate policy and whether it will commit to net zero by 2050. A senior Liberal joins us later on. And then we'll remember a titan of Australian radio.
John Laws, thank you very much for making time to speak to us tonight.
Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it, did you?
Yeah, I loved every minute.
How about that voice of John Laws? It's so unmistakable, isn't it?
We'll have more on the life of the late John Laws, who has died at the age of 90 after a seven-decade career in the media. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thanks for being here for another week of The Breakfast Wrap. We're going to start in New South Wales, where the police and state government are reviewing how neo-Nazis were able to legally rally in Sydney on the weekend. The scenes were pretty confronting. Around 60 people, clad in black, stood outside the state parliament alongside a banner that read, "Abolish the Jewish Lobby." Premier Chris Minns and Police Commissioner Mal Lanyon say that they weren't actually notified ahead of the rally when the group, under the name White Australia, formally lodged their protest plans with police. The Premier is now flagging toughening up the state's laws.
If we had our time again, that rally wouldn't have taken place. But obviously we're going to take steps in the future to give the police the resources they need to ensure that a rally like that doesn't take place on the steps of the People's House.
So as you can imagine, plenty of questions about how this was able to happen. We wanted to hear from the New South Wales government, so Sally Sara interviewed Yasmin Catley, the New South Wales Police Minister.
What's happened? What's gone wrong here?
Look, what we saw on Saturday was deeply distressing. Anti-Semitism and hate speech, they have absolutely no place in New South Wales, and we will not tolerate this behaviour on our streets. Racist ideology designed to divide Australians and spread anti-Semitism in our community, it is not free speech, it is hate speech, and we need to take action to confront it. As we know, the Commissioner has said there has been a communication breakdown in his office, and he will be reviewing that and addressing that.
What should have happened? What's the process?
Well, the Form 1 was lodged as is a normal process. I think that I certainly should have been advised of particularly this group. There's no doubt about that. It would have been best had I have been advised. There is no doubt about that. But we now know that we need to make sure that the police have the tools that they need to make arrests when this type of hateful, vile, disgusting behaviour is on the streets of New South Wales.
As a government, we will not tolerate it. What powers don't they have currently that they need?
Well, it's, they're very tricky, these neo-Nazis. They skirt around the edge of the law. They come in with a quick protest, doesn't make a lot of public ruffles, but certainly a big online presence. But they come in quick in small numbers and then they leave so that they can have their social media.
So just to bring you back to the question, what extra powers do police have?
Yep, I'm going to answer that. So, in that being the case, it's very difficult for police to make decisions, in real time, whilst all this is going on, whether or not they have actually crossed the line from freedom of speech to hate speech. But they're going to be looking at those, all of those footage, and they'll be able to see if there has been any breaches of the law, and they will apply those.
The paperwork for Saturday's rally was filed 7 days prior by a well-known leader of what's known as the National Socialist Network under the rebranded name of White Australia. Why didn't that trigger a response?
Well, look, it is concerning that we weren't advised of that and there wasn't early visibility. But as I've said, the Commissioner of Police is undertaking an urgent review of the circumstances, why we didn't know what was happening and what will need to change.
The protest was also aimed at these new hate speech laws, making it an offence to publicly incite hatred towards another person or group. The neo-Nazi protesters singled out Jewish people as police watched on. Why weren't there arrests or at least any move along direction once the speeches got ugly?
Well, as I said, the police will be looking at all of that footage there, and they will... If there were any breaches, I can assure you, they will absolutely make arrests. But I think it's important that we know that this group won't stop on one brief rally. They won't stop targeting one group. They won't stop with Jewish Australians. They will target other cultural groups, and we need to confront them. I absolutely believe that we need to take action to confront them. There needs to be civic action from the Australian community standing up against this kind of racism.
So you'd like counter-protests?
That is not what I'm saying at all. But we need to call it out, and that's exactly what the Premier is doing. It's what the government will do. We need to call it out to say we will not tolerate this sort of racism on our streets.
Has the government or will the government meet with Jewish leaders to formally apologise for what's taken place here?
Well, I've already spoken to Jewish leaders, and in fact, I was at Kristallnacht last night with the Jewish community, and they are good people. And of course, I'm certain that the Premier, and I know that the Police Commissioner, has spoken with them as well.
And that's Yasmin Catley there, the New South Wales Police Minister, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. It's felt like a lifetime since the Nationals abandoned net zero by 2050, but it's only been a little over a week. In the next few days, the Liberal Party will meet to decide their position on the matter. One of those who'll be in the room is New South Wales Senator Maria Kovacic, the Shadow Assistant Minister to the Leader of the Opposition. She joined Sally, who kicked off with some of the comments from her colleague on Insiders over the weekend.
Your colleague, Senator Andrew Bragg, indicated yesterday he thought it extremely unlikely the Liberal Party will change its policy to abandon net zero or leave the 2015 Paris Agreement. Take a listen.
I don't imagine that we would ever leave Paris. I mean, we're a party of government, right? We're not a fringe party. We're not, fringe dwellers. Most Australians want us to play our fair role in terms of emissions reduction. So I just don't think that we're going to be leaving the Paris Agreement.
Senator, do you agree with Andrew Bragg's assessment?
Look, I do, and I think that he's articulated that well. And what I focus on is the fact that Australians do want practical action on climate. The challenge is they don't want the higher bills that we're seeing now, and they don't want the empty promises that come with that. And this is what voters are telling me as I work across the electorate, the entire state of New South Wales, which I think gives senators a particularly different insight. You know, voters in Bradfield, in Bennelong, in Reid, in Parramatta, in McKellar, in Warringah, in Banks and in Hughes, these are all seats where we used to have Liberal MPs and we don't anymore. And they are telling us that they want credible policy on climate, but they also want to see their bills come down. Where the issue is there's been a failure of the Labor government's energy policy where they haven't seen those bills come down and emissions have flatlined. The expectation of Australians is that they deliver on their net zero promise and they've been unable to do that. That is the problem we are facing here.
If the Liberal Party drops its commitment to net zero and or to the Paris Agreement, would it be tenable for you to stay with the party?
I'm not going to speculate on things like that. I am a Liberal. I've been a Liberal for a very long time. I'm a believer in our Westminster system. And look, if as you know often occurs, if there are challenges in relation to party room positions, and that's a matter for those individuals. But ultimately, I'm on the record as being someone who supports our commitments to net zero, noting the fact that it's this government's ability to deliver on that that is failing, as opposed to being a problem with net zero itself. And I think that distinction is a very, very important one. So, you know, Australians aren't telling us that they don't want to look after the environment. The coalition led by Liberal prime ministers have been stewards in this space. We are the ones that have led this work under prime ministers Abbott, Turnbull and Morrison.
But there has been criticism of the coalition wasting a lot of time on getting its policies in order and taking action on things like emissions.
Not at all. I think if you look at the fact that we're 6 months out from an election, the worst result we've had in a long time, where over the last term there hasn't really been any robust discussion on policy, this is entirely necessary. We went to the last election with an energy policy that came out just 3 months out. And the reality is this work, the heavy lifting that our leader Susan Lee is doing at the moment, this should have been done after the 2022 election, when we got our first clear message. But let's be frank, we didn't listen to it, and here we are today doing probably what we should have been doing 3 years ago.
Can the coalition function if the Nationals and the Liberals have different policies on emissions, at net zero and Paris?
Look, it can. And I think, again, the distinction here is we are in opposition. We are not in government. We have 2.5 years until the next election. And our job now is to prosecute the failing energy policy of the government, which is having a significant impact on the lives of Australians and the increasing burden of cost of living. That is the number one challenge for Australians. And what they want to see from us is a plan to manage that. They want to see economic credibility, and they want to see energy certainty. And that hasn't been delivered. That is the problem that we have today.
With the meetings to settle climate policy this week, what is at stake for the Liberal Party if it gets these policies wrong?
I think the challenge for us is that if we get these policies wrong, if we get the way we articulate this to Australians wrong, then our ability to regain this trust will be further damaged. We need to be frank about the circumstances that we face. Australians do not trust us to lead them. We need to show them that we have made the changes that they expect in terms of our focus areas, again, cost of living, energy credibility and energy reliability, to say, yes, you actually are hearing what we've said. These are families who are struggling, small businesses who want a fair go, and young Australians who want to go, yes, you are offering me something that shows me that you are thinking about my future. And to date, we haven't done that.
You were just listening to the Liberal Senator Maria Kovacic on Radio National Breakfast with Sally Sarah. Straight after that, our political correspondent Melissa Clark came on with Sally for her analysis.
What we have there is the issues, or a rendering of the issues, as the coalition has been trying to wrestle with for the better part of a decade and a half now. That's two of the three parts of the trilemma we used to hear about, talked about in the Malcolm Turnbull days of the coalition. It is how to deal with tackling climate change and trying to look after the costs that are involved in that, as well as the reliability of the grid. But I think what we see with this is that the electricity grid is central to this question for the coalition, because it is the low-hanging fruit of dealing with climate action, and it is, of course, a key contributor to the cost of power bills. But if we were to look at this like any other infrastructure, we would not be approaching it in the way that the coalition has. If we were talking about building a bridge rather than reforming the electricity grid, you wouldn't be in a position where you would start building a bridge and then change your policy to know, well, we want to start building a tunnel instead, and then go, oh, no, actually, we just want to have a detour around the thing we want to build a bridge over, and then decide, no, actually, we need a ferry policy. But that's effectively what we've had from the coalition over much of the last decade and a half is a continual change into approach of what do we need to do with this space. And in the meantime, the problem has kept getting worse. Coal-fired power stations have exited the grid. Renewables aren't being built as quickly as ideal to meet the climate aims. So Maria Kovacic is saying, well, we need to focus on government accountability. Now, that would be a sensible approach in that it would allow a solution, the government's approach to this, to proceed. So at least there is some action. But it still leaves open a very big question. What would they do in government?
And what did you make of Senator Kovacic's comments on the Liberals and Nationals possibly holding different positions on climate change?
Yeah, Maria Kovacic was saying that they can function as a coalition if they're at different positions. She's saying the distinction is we're in opposition and 2.5 years from an election. That can work, but I'm not sure how sustainable that is rather than just kicking the can down the road. Because in electoral terms, they'd still need to be able to articulate to voters come election time what they would do. And if they've spent 2.5 years having different policies on this, it would be hard to argue to the public that you can unify it. It also leaves them open to political attack on a question of what they would do in government. So if this is the compromise that they're heading towards, it could be an interim approach to have different policies, but it won't solve the longer term issue that the coalition has of not being capable of reconciling a position on this.
Mel Clark there. And no doubt we'll be monitoring this story right across the week on Radio National Breakfast. And of course, right here on The Breakfast Wrap. We're going to end talking about the life and legacy of John Laws. He was one of the pioneers of Australian talkback radio, and on the weekend, he died at the age of 90. He was once described by former Prime Minister Paul Keating as the broadcaster of the century. The man known as the Golden Tonsils was both loved and feared by Prime Ministers for his political pull. He interviewed 17 of them across his 7 decades on air. This morning, tributes from right across the political aisle have been pouring in for him, including from one of the 17 prime ministers that he interviewed, Anthony Albanese, saying that John Laws was respected for telling it straight, digging deep and giving guests a chance to be heard. The federal opposition leader, Susan Lee, saying that he helped shape public debate in a style that was unmistakably his own. He was a true pioneer of broadcasting. And then there's also what Nationals MP and former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has said. God help you if you tried to fool him. He had the facts, could read you like a pop-up book, and would eviscerate you on peak hour ratings. He also became the story a couple times, John Laws, during, you know, the famous cash for comment saga, and then in the early 2000s when he received a suspended jail term for interviewing a juror on air. But one of the moments that he will really be remembered for was an interview he did with Lee Sales on 7:30 more than a decade ago. Sitting in his armchair at home with a glass of bourbon in hand, answering questions like this.
John Laws, thank you very much for making time to speak to us tonight.
Did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it, did you?
Yeah, I loved every minute.
A very memorable interview with John Laws on the other side of that interview. Well, Steve Price is a longtime broadcaster and former colleague of John Laws. Steve, g'day. Welcome to Breakfast.
Great to be with you, Sally. And how about that voice of John Laws? It's so unmistakable, isn't it?
It certainly is. How do you reflect on the career of John Laws?
He was an original and probably we throw the word legend around pretty loosely in this country, but I think you could certainly claim that John Laws was a legend. He was at one point the highest paid radio personality in the world, let alone Australia. He was on, you know, 55, 56 stations around the country. And I think, Sally, that's one of the things that really stood out with me for John. He had a huge ego, but he loved talking to people. When he got someone on the line talking on the radio, he listened to them. And I think his great talent, John Laws, to be honest, was that he was a listener. He didn't shout at people. He didn't come on and editorialise in some sort of foaming way. He listened to people and he talked to them. I think that was his talent.
And how important do you think John Laws was politically as well? Because the rise of talkback radio, which happened during his time, it changed the way that politics was playing out.
Look, I think it certainly did. I think you're absolutely spot on there. I mean, he had a great relationship with Paul Keating. I mean, famously, Keating in a phone hookup from overseas, talked about how Australia might end up becoming a banana republic. That was with John Laws. And Keating famously said that if you want to educate the people of Australia, you have to educate John Laws first. And there was a memorable time where Keating and Laws were having lunch, and Keating interrupted the lunch and took him to the Reserve Bank to get the governor of the Reserve Bank to explain to Laws what was happening in the economy. So, and funnily, you know, a lot of us talkback hosts obviously lean, you know, to the more conservative side of politics. Mm. I could never pick John's politics. I didn't really know where he stood, which is a credit to him. I mean, he was down the middle. He was admired by Labor politicians, Labor prime ministers, Hawke, Keating, etc. But he was also had a great relationship with someone like John Howard. So he was down the middle, I think.
It was a controversial career at times. He was blunt sometimes. How did he think of his role behind the microphone?
John was always obviously very happy with his place in broadcasting. He knew that he had massive talent and that he was listened to by politicians and by the public. I mean, look, there were times he and I had a couple of clashes, and there was the cash for comment period of his life, which I know harmed him greatly. He was he thought he would be had been badly done by there. I mean, this was where if you did a live commercial on radio, if you were being paid by that advertiser, you then had to declare it. So what Laws did in the end was whenever he mentioned a client that he was being paid by, he would ring a cowbell, which only John Laws could get away with doing that. In the 80s and 90s, he owned Talkback Radio. And, I there's been a lot of people since, but I don't think there's been anyone near as good as him.
When you were talking about cash for comment there, was that a necessary reckoning for John Laws and for the industry as well to make clear those lines?
100%. I mean, this ended up before the tribunal. I mean, Alan Jones was involved and John Laws. They were the two main people that were examined. And the public had a right to know that, you know, if you were being paid by an airline or a bank or whoever to read their commercials on air, the public had a right to know that that was the case. And that's what the tribunal ended up getting people to do. Alan Jones ended up not then doing live commercials. John ran the cowbell. But, yes, it was a reckoning that had to happen in that industry. I was involved in it myself, and I think they did the right thing by changing the way it was all done.
Steve, the era of radio in Australia that John Laws dominated, is that era over now? Have things changed a lot?
Well, social media's changed everything we do now, Sally, hasn't it? I mean, yes. Does it have the influence that it had in the 80s and 90s? Possibly not. There are still giant figures who work in both commercial and ABC talk radio that have an impact on the way politicians think. I mean, here I am talking to you. I mean, your program has political influence, and that's just the fact that you've got a big audience and that audience listens to what you say and they trust you. So I think it was probably dominated more by commercial talkback radio in the 80s and 90s. Will it ever get back to that point? No. And, you know, will newspapers ever sell as many papers as they used to? No. Everything's changed. Social media's done it to us.
Steve, just finally, was he good fun? I used to see him even in recent years out to lunch a lot in various places around Sydney. You'd look through a window walking past and there he was holding court. Was he fun?
Fun, you've got no idea. He once said to me, "We're going to Otto for lunch today. I'll pick you up at the front of the building." He turned up in a Rolls-Royce Phantom, right, which had, you know, reverse opening doors, and off we sped over the Harbour Bridge. And we got there and there was a silver-plated ice bucket full of two bottles of Chardonnay. And we sat there just laughing and talking, sitting in the sun, and he did that just about every day of his life.
And that's Steve Price, a longtime broadcaster and a former colleague of the late John Laws. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Sally Sarah, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josie Asher. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and tomorrow we will have a very special episode of The Breakfast Wrap.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Nothing will save the Governor-General.
Live from Old Parliament House in Canberra, Radio National Breakfast will be bringing you coverage of the 50th anniversary of the dismissal of Gough Whitlam. And right here on The Breakfast Wrap, we'll bring you all the reflections and the stories. So make sure you're tuning in on Radio National and also the ABC Listen app.